this is Kendra. April is not able to make it today, so you guys are lucky and get to listen to me do a solo episode, which feels really, really strange, by the way. Like, sitting here in my living room talking to myself out loud, because, I mean, let's face it, I have conversations with myself in my head all day long, but when it comes to, like, actually out loud, I try not to do that too much, but I guess I have to make an exception today. I don't have a whole lot of announcements right now. There are no updates on either of the cases that I have been following that I gave updates on last time. We're still sitting at 37 states. I will have to update the map because I have yet to figure out which other state joined since we had 36 last time. But either way, there's some states out there that obviously need to tune in. And I don't think that we've added any more countries. I think that we've added some more provinces, districts, etc. within those countries, but I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to go back and look. But I thought I would let you guys know, like, what platforms are listening to us as far as listening platforms. Apple Podcasts is 32% of our listeners. Spotify has 21%. Anchor, Samsung Podcast, and Google Podcast make up 6%. Amazon Music and Stitcher make up 5%. And Audible, web browser, makes up 3%, and other, whatever that may be, whether it's Radio Public, iHeartRadio, etc., makes up the other 13%. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. I guess I'm going to kind of go. You guys hear that? I said the A-M-A-Z-O-N word, and now it's talking to me. Stop, Amazon. There you go. I guess that'll be my partner today. Okay. So I am kind of bringing you guys today a case that I wanted to cover a while ago. It's been a while. But I thought I could find some more information on where this person is today. And I really can't. And I finally kind of started understanding that that could be for a reason, you know. People don't always want to stay in the spotlight just because they're a survivor of something. And so that's what this case is. I'm going to jump right in here. When we think of people that's like abducted, especially older than small children, it's not the percentage of abductions by strangers, like perpetrated by strangers, is very, very small. And the majority of abductions are by someone that the victim knows, no matter how small of a connection they may have, which is what makes this following story kind of even more terrifying, because a stranger abduction of a almost adult or a teenager in broad daylight from a busy mall parking lot is even lower percentage. And the fact that this is a survivor makes it even harder to believe, because if a teenager gets abducted by a stranger, usually after 24 hours, there's the slimmest chance that you're going to find them alive. And that's just statistics. After 6 days, though, the unbelievable part is that she is. And it's just absolutely nuts. Oh, and my screen went off. Sorry, I have the notes here. And I know that this case itself, I remember this one personally happening because it occurred very close to my hometown, and it involved a teenager that was only 3 years older than I was at the time. So I remember hearing about it and reading about it and thinking how crazy it was, and even worse, how scary it was that it happened this way. This is just a remarkable story about this one. She's so brave and she's so smart and so quick thinking. Like, I wouldn't have had the state of mind to be nearly as quick thinking as this young lady was at that point in my life. So I'm just going to go right into it here. So I'm taking us right now to Kearney, Nebraska in April of 2001. Now, the 2000 census showed that Kearney had a population at the time of 27,500 people. The population now, according to the 2021 census, it's almost at 34,000. It is a university town. The University of Nebraska at Kearney is there, so you know, it's a pretty it's bigger than or it's smaller than Grand Island, but as far as has college life, it has what I would consider probably more middle to upper class than Grand Island. Sorry, Grand Island. So, when 17-year-old Anne Slutty woke up on the morning of April 6, 2001, she had no idea that by that evening at 7 p.m., her entire life would be changed forever. It was a typical Friday for Anne, who was an honor student and in the last month of her senior year of high school. She was also an accomplished pole vaulter on the track team and had recently, just recently, been accepted into the college of her choice. That afternoon after school, Anne returned home after track practice and found a surprise waiting for her at her parents' house. Her older brother, Thomas, or Tom, was back in town for a visit, which Anne was absolutely thrilled about as she had not seen her brother since he had enlisted in the Air Force 2 years earlier in 1999. Their parents, Don and Elaine, were also visibly happy to have the entire family around the dinner table once again. When dinner was finished, Anne said that she was going to head to the mall for a newly released CD she had been wanting. CDs, that dated it all. God, I remember CDs, having to burn them on the computer and like save them to whatever. I don't even know if I have any anymore. I should look. Anyway, she was then going to hang out with her best friend and boyfriend afterwards. Her mom warned her in a teasing way that her curfew was midnight, though she wasn't much worried as Anne was responsible and they didn't usually need to worry about her being out past then. Around 7 p.m., Anne exited the Kearney Hilltop Mall after making a few purchases. Now, on this evening, since it was early spring, but the sun still wouldn't have set until about 8 p.m. or so it's light out still, really light, it's still fully light out, and the mall was busy. I mean, at that time, as was normal for a Friday evening, and this was in 2001 when malls had not basically died out. Or are slowly dying out like they are now. I mean, I remember still at that time, I think a freshman in high school. Yeah, I was a freshman in high school. I still remember going to the mall on Friday nights with my friends. So it's not, I mean, it's going to be fairly busy out in that parking lot. And you always have kind of this sense of security in the daylight, especially when you're in a public shopping center, a mall, and many of us aren't going to be paying that much attention to our surroundings, at least not as much as we would if it was like as if it was nighttime and the parking lot was almost empty, right? Or even nowadays, think about if you're at a store when it's really close to closing and you walk out when it's dark. I mean, I pay attention to my surroundings. Maybe that's just because I'm a true crime podcaster, but sometimes I'm not all the time. And so when it's broad daylight in a fairly crowded mall parking lot, you're not necessarily thinking anything's going to happen. And so Anne, who was probably not paying that much attention, and especially not paying attention to the blue SUV that was parked next to her, you know, she was just going to her car until a man approached her, pointed a gun at her, and forced her into the driver's side of that SUV. Anne scrambled over the passenger seat and tried to escape out the passenger side door. Unfortunately, the man, Anthony Wright, who is also known as Tony Zappa, quickly caught her. Now, if you look up this case, you'll see him referred to as Tony Zappa most of the time. However, in the court documents that I found, it's Anthony Wright. So I'm going to be referring to him as by his last name. I'm just going to be referring to him as Wright throughout this entire thing for consistency. She began to scream loudly for help, alerting other mall shoppers that something was wrong. And if they had any doubt at all about what was happening, that soon went out the window as Wright, who stood 6 feet, weighed almost 250 pounds, and had at one point been an aspiring boxer, began to pummel and hit the petite 5'3" Anne in the head until she blacked out. He was then able to push her back into the vehicle and immediately leave the parking lot. So, mind you, that probably took place within like 2 minutes, 3 minutes at the most. And since Anne was heard screaming as she tried to fight him off, Several witnesses did see what was happening, and they did immediately call 911 when they realized it. But even though these calls were made immediately, and Kearney was not a large city, by the time any police officers got there, the SUV was long gone. Because remember, it couldn't have taken them one, 2 or 3 minutes to subdue her and push her back into this SUV. Officer Michael Bogard was one of the first to respond and saw Anne's belongings on the ground, which included her mittens, music CDs that she had just purchased, her purse, and her ID. Her mother was able to confirm that the items were her daughter, Anne's. Meanwhile, Anne was blacked out from the hits on her head and was on the floorboard of Wright's vehicle while he traveled north from Kearney. Eventually, she woke up when they arrived at... Eventually, she woke when they arrived at a gas station in Ainsworth, Nebraska around 10:15 p.m. Now, Ainsworth is about 157 miles or about 2.5 miles from Kearney and heading towards the South Dakota border. When stopping at the gas station, Wright made Anne get back on the floorboard and used a chain to bind her hands and feet and told her to stay quiet. Wright then headed inside of the station and asked for directions from the clerk. The clerk that spoke to him said that he had looked outside to the SUV, but didn't see anyone inside. So when questioned later on, he said, I didn't see anybody. So continuing to travel north for about 27 miles towards Springview, Nebraska, which was about 13 miles from the South Dakota border, Wright accidentally, I'm not sure how this happened, but he did, he rolled the SUV into a ditch. After escaping the vehicle, both of them, he wrapped the chain around Anne's wrist and then walked to a nearby farmhouse where he stole a pickup. He attempted to use the truck to get the SUV out of the ditch, but was unable to. Wright then had Anne get into the passenger seat of the stolen pickup and drove into town to steal a front-end loader. And this, for anyone who doesn't know, is basically a small tractor with a large bucket attached to the front used to move large loads of dirt. Think of like a caterpillar. Something like that. He then used the front loader to get the SUV out of the ditch. While he was preoccupied with this task, Anne did the first thing to kind of drop a trail of clues behind her. So she starts using her head. She starts doing things that, okay, maybe somebody will pick up on this. She was able to remove the chain from her wrist and threw them into a ditch where it was later recovered by a neighbor and given to the local sheriff. So exactly what she wanted to happen. Once back in the SUV, and it never really said, like I got a lot of this from one of the court documents when he filed an appeal later on. It doesn't really ever say like if he noticed that the chain was gone or if he just didn't do anything, but either way, they got back into the SUV and he took her over state lines into South Dakota. And while still heading west and stopping the Suburban in a field. At that time, I mean, this was the next day too. At that time, Anne believed they were in Wyoming, which, good for her. At least she's going in the right direction. I wouldn't have had any idea whatsoever. I don't know what direction I'm facing right now. I have no internal compass or sense of direction whatsoever. So Wright then used duct tape and bound her hands behind her back and her legs together in several places before blindfolding her. So remember, her hands are bound behind her back, her legs are together in several places, and she's blindfolded. Wright then told Anne, well, I'll make you a deal. If you can get the tape off, I'll let you go. And using more wherewithal than I would have had at that point, she was actually able to somehow hop over to a barbed wire fence where she tried to cut the duct tape from her wrist. I don't know if any of you guys have been around barbed wire. I would assume some of you have. I know some of you have. But that, I mean, it's just a really thick wire. Think about it this way. Really thick wire with barbs every once in a while. They're not like all in a row necessarily. So trying to cut tape with it, it's going to be almost impossible and you're going to injure yourself in the process, which is unfortunately like that's what she did. So now I've lost my place. So in the process, though, she did cut her hands and wrists and realized she wasn't going to be able to get this tape off. And so she asked Wright to remove it, because it was starting to hurt her. He responded with, "No, you whine too much." After continuing to watch her struggle, Wright removed first the duct tape from around her legs and then attempted to remove the tape from her wrist using first a key, then a glass shard, and then a razor blade. But he had used so much duct tape that he couldn't get it off and it was too tight. And eventually, he had to burn it off of her with a lighter, which in turn burned her. So that tells you, I mean, yes, duct tape was supposed to last till the end of the world, but it shouldn't be that hard to take off, like if he had just wrapped it around her wrist a couple times. So he had to wrap it around there so many times and so tight that he had to use a lighter to burn it off of her wrist. Later that evening, between 9:50 and 10 p.m., Wright told Anne to call one of her friends, but not her parents, and to tell the friend that she had gone on vacation, because that's going to make a lot of sense, right? She's 17 years old, and she's just going to go on vacation, and her friend is going to believe her when it's totally out of character. But you have to remember, also, Wright did not know Anne at all. At all. Complete stranger to her. Complete stranger. And so, Wright held his ear closely to the phone, though, when she did call, so he could monitor the conversation. Anne called home and asked for Elaine. Now, remember, Elaine is Anne's mother, but since Wright did not know Anne, he wouldn't have any idea that that was her mother's name. A friend of the family answered the phone and spoke to Anne, though. When Anne made no mention of being on vacation, Wright became angry and made her hang up. He told her to call another friend. Anne called her friend, Janessa Caja. When Caja asked where she was, Anne was forced again to hang up the phone. So at least at this point, her family, a friend, they know that she is alive. So, I mean, that had to have been such reassurance to them. Because at this point, it's like the next day. So she's been gone over 12 hours, probably going on 24 hours almost at this point. So that had to have been a relief. To a certain extent, they're like, okay, she's still alive. We don't know where she is, but she's still alive. So the next morning, so that would have been April 7th. So the next morning on April 8th, 2001, Wright again duct taped Anne's legs and wrist and used duct tape to blindfold her. Just a little trigger alert here. There is going to be some assault stuff, so if you want to skip ahead a little bit and get past that, go for it. He drove her to a remote area near Livingston, Montana, and cut her clothes off with a knife. She begged him not to rape her and told him that she was still a virgin. And this does wind up being true. It is determined to be true later on. He raped her anyway. He then told her he was going to take her into the mountains and rape her 4 times a day. So, complete piece of shit. Complete piece of shit. He doesn't know her from anyone else. She is still a virgin. And he rapes her. He takes away something from her that she cannot get back. I cannot even imagine how that would have been like. I can't. Later that morning, Wright took Anne while he broke into a cabin just west of Livingston. There, he stole a rifle. They then went to a different cabin nearby. While Wright was upstairs in the cabin, Anne found a telephone, turned on the water, and turned up a radio and dialed 911 and asked for help. Again, I wouldn't have even tried this. I'd have been so terrified to even do this. And here she is, like, just, nope, I'm going to do it. She told the 911 dispatcher that she was from Nebraska. She had been kidnapped. And I believe that she told the dispatcher her name, too. And Wright saw, though, that Anne was on the phone and started yelling at her. Obviously took the phone away from her and hung it up. Either way, here we go again. you know, this is the next day after making that first phone call home. So again, they know that she's alive. You know, they have a better location now because she used a landline phone. So that's good too. So Wright took some items from the cabin, loaded up the Suburban, and ordered her to get in and lie down on the seat. As they drove away, he yelled at her, asking her why she has called the police and saying things like, "I might as well shoot you in the head now," and "it's all over for you." Unfortunately, I mean, by the time the sheriff and SWAT team arrived at the cabin, Wright and Ann were long gone by then. After leaving Livingston, Wright took Ann to Belgrade, Montana. He broke into another house. He's got this thing about houses, I don't know. Ransacked it and raped her a second time. He then took her next door to John Kuhn's house. But Kuhn had opened the door and saw a large man standing next to a young woman with a black eye. Kuhn would later identify the man as Anthony Wright and the woman as Ann Slutty. Upon being seen by Kuhn, Wright immediately took Ann to the next house. So he was in one house, ransacked it, went next door to the next house. Dude answers the door, and he decides to go next door to the next house? I don't comprehend the logic there. I mean, a guy already saw you with the young lady with a black eye. You get freaked out and go to the next house, and then you're not thinking this is going to be a cause for concern. Apparently he didn't, though. So as he went into the next house, though, he kicked in the front door where he took a piggy bank, Pete's sake, some food and lingerie. I mean, at least the food seems logical, but the piggy bank? I don't know how much money you're going to get from that. He then stole a blue Toyota Tercel and abandoned the Suburban. Because once again, they're not going to notice that their car is stolen. Either way, he drove until he came upon a group of summer cabins. Again, cabins. This guy in cabins. At Salmon Lake, Montana. He broke into a red cabin where they stayed for the next 2 days. When they got there, though, he removed the phone from the wall, smashed it, placed it in the stove, and burned it to make sure that Ann was unable to use it to try to call anyone again. He proceeded then to burn the clothing that he had previously cut off of Ann. He raped her for a third time in the master bedroom during these 2 days. Ann knew that Wright was trying to destroy evidence of what had occurred, and knowing that she had seen his face already, one could only imagine what was going through her mind. Because I know I'd be thinking, he's destroying evidence, I've seen his face, he's already said that he's going to shoot me, I'm going to die here. And so even in that panic that I'm sure she felt, that fear, that awfulness, she was able to quickly use her head again. And she took her semen-stained underwear and put it in a kitchen trash can in this cabin in the hopes that it would be found later and used as evidence. She also hid 2 notes in case the owners of the cabin came back. She wrote inside one paperback book, quote, "Ann Slutty, 4-10-01, help. I love my mom, dad, and brother." And then she placed that book back on the shelf. She left another note that said, "Ann Slutty was here April 2001," and put that behind the kitchen windowsill. Both of those notes were later found. But she was doing that in case, at that point, she's assuming that, like, she's probably not going to make it home. And she wanted to make sure that people followed this trail and could find the person. Leaving Salmon Lake, Wright continued to travel further northwest in Montana. He stopped twice during this time, once to fill up the car with gas and a second time to purchase ammunition. Before entering the store for the ammo, he chained Ann's wrists and feet, taped her mouth shut, and placed her in the trunk of the car. On April 10th, now 4 days into the abduction, Wright arrived at Flathead Lake near Rawlins, Rollins. Sorry if I said that wrong. It's either Rollins or Rollins. Sorry, Montana. Almost 900 miles from where he first abducted her and broke into yet another cabin by kicking down the door. That night, while Wright was in the bathroom, Sluti turned on the television quietly and learned that police knew of her kidnapping and were searching for both the Suburban and the Toyota Tercel. So that probably gave her a little hope, like, if I can just hold, if they can just get here, if I can just do something. And the next day, Wright saw the news too and became very upset. He remarked, "Oh, if we're going to get caught, we might as well have fun," and told her to take her clothes off. When she refused, he took them off and raped her for a fourth time. Biggest piece of shit. Like, "Oh, we might as well have some fun." No, that's not fun. That's not fun. Sick and demented. But on April 11th, a neighbor, however, observed the Toyota Tercel backed up to the cabin, which was supposed to be empty, so he knew something was off, and he notified the sheriff's office a little after 5 p.m. Now, obviously, they've had this bolo, so be on the lookout for this Tercel for a while. And so Detective Andrew Cannon arrived at approximately 5:40 p.m. and met with several other sheriff's office employees who were blocking off the roads leading to the cabin. And mind you, the neighbor called at 5 and they got there at 5:40. I'm not sure, though, where they're at in Montana. I'm going to assume that between wherever these sheriffs were and officers were in this area, since I think they're kind of summer cabin type of a thing, it could have taken them a while to get there. So I'm not going to bash on and be like, "Why did it take them 40 minutes to get there? That's ridiculous." I'm going to imagine, with it being Montana, it might have taken a little bit. So before the officers arrived at that particular cabin, Wright was able to get Ann into the car and drive it to yet another cabin. I don't know if he was trying to get decorating ideas, maybe an idea of what a summer home looked like. I don't know. But he kicked in the door again, but this time concealed the Toyota Tercel in the garage. He then barricaded the doors with furniture, so he's got to know the cops are closing in on him. It didn't take long, though, for the officers to discover the second cabin and surround it. But Wright refused to surrender, and a 10-hour standoff ensued. During the standoff, Wright threatened to torture or kill Anne if she made any noises. He also told her to make multiple phone calls to 911, her family, and to Wright's mother and wife. And he urged Sluti to tell them all that she had not been kidnapped. Wright also refused to speak to authorities that surrounded the cabin until minutes before the surrender. Instead, he forced Anne to talk into the phone and relay messages between the two parties. But it was clear that he had hovered over Anne while she talked, Lake County Under Sheriff Mike Sargent said. She never referred to Wright by name until the end. Quote, "Can I talk to Tony?" Sargent asked. Quote, "That's entirely up to him," Sargent recalled Anne saying. She said, quote, "Talk to them, Tony." Wright's voice was almost a whisper when he spoke. "I'm scared they're going to shoot me," he said, according to Sargent. He made two demands, Sargent said. He didn't want officers to shoot him, and he wanted to serve his prison time in Minnesota. Guess what, dude? You don't have a choice, first of all, whether or not they shoot you. You do, as long as you don't come out with your gun blazing, they shouldn't. And I don't think they're going to want to, because they're going to want to try your ass. Second, though, you get a decision on where you serve your goddamn time. No, that's not it. And I like how he whispers into his phone, "I'm afraid they're going to shoot me." What the hell did you expect to happen, you dumbass? You kidnapped a 17-year-old girl in the middle of broad daylight. Hello? So, He finally surrendered at 3:15 a.m. on Thursday, April 12th, 6 days after being abducted. Anne's ordeal was over. She ran out of the cabin towards the FBI agents, realizing that she was actually going to be going home. Wright was taken into custody, and it was later revealed that he had been eluding authorities since February. And this is April, so since February, he'd been eluding authorities for failing to appear in a Minnesota court on a burglary charge. He was also wanted on charges that included assault, theft, and illegal gun possession in Nebraska, Louisiana, Iowa, and Wisconsin. So, stellar human being already, I mean, even before the kidnapping. Authorities called Anne Sloody very clever and very brave, and said that she was instrumental in persuading Wright to surrender. The next day, after they realized that she was safe, on Friday, April 13th, more than 200 people attended a celebration at the University of Nebraska-Kearney, where Sloody's father, Don, was an associate professor of management and marketing. They joined hands, circled the university's bell tower, and observed a silent prayer in support of the family. Anne was able to return home to Kearney on Saturday, April 14th, 2001. So, 8 days after she had been abducted. She had a bruise under her right eye and an FBI baseball cap on her head when she stepped off a private jet with her parents and her brother. Despite all she had been through, though, she was still able to give a big smile and a wave to the small group of family members and friends who shrieked with excitement. Okay, now we're going to go into the court case that happened afterwards for Anthony Wright. I wanted to start with something I find humorous in a way, just because it just shows this dude is either off his rocker, but not really because he's not insane, but just how unbelievable he is. Now, I'm not exactly sure of the date that his trial actually started. I didn't come across it anywhere, but I know during the first week of it, there's one incident that certainly stood out. He slapped his own defense attorney across the face. His own attorney. He backhanded him in the middle of the trial. And this prompted his removal from the courtroom after being tackled by federal marshals. The jury was quickly ushered out as the situation was brought under control. And 3 hours later, Wright was returned to the courtroom and asked by the judge if he was ready to continue. Wright, though he complained about his attorneys, which included public defender David Stickman, who was the one he had backhanded, and one other one, but this was public defense. So this, he didn't have money for his own attorney. He doesn't like the one he has, apparently, for some reason. Backhanded him. It's like, beggars can't be choosers, dude. Too bad. And told the judge, quote, "I'll sit here and I'll be quiet. I don't want these two around me no more. I'll just sit here perfect." Good, because slapping your own attorney doesn't help your case any. And I mean, not that there's much that could help it, but, you know. Wright had already interrupted his trial several times with outbursts and complaints at this point. He was handcuffed and removed from the courtroom for 1 day at the start of his trial for shouting at the judge and the jury. Wright had repeatedly asked that his attorneys be removed, saying they are ineffective, but the judge declined to do so. Stickman and defense attorney Alan Stoller, so those were his attorneys, called 3 witnesses to the stand that day before Wright's attack on Stickman, and they had been planning to wrap up their defense by the end of the day. And his defense was trying to prove that Anne voluntarily went with Wright to Montana. So they were trying to make it seem like she got into his vehicle and went with him on her own free will. The defense tried to show her cooperation with Wright by calling witnesses to the stand. 16-year-old Carrie Hoffman was working at a Burger King at Belgrade when Wright ordered a meal from a drive-thru window 2 days after Ann Slutty was allegedly kidnapped. She said Ann, who was sitting in the passenger seat of the vehicle, did not ask for help. And of course she didn't. She was freaking terrified. I don't think that I would have been able to ask for help. Quote, she thanked me, smiled, and seemed very polite, Hoffman said. Now, for me, when I say thank you to people from like a drive-thru or at a restaurant or retail stores, like that is like an automatic thing because that's what I was taught to do. So her being polite and saying thank you goes more to the testament of how she was raised than her being complacent and wanting to be with this dude. You know, I wouldn't put any stock in that whatsoever. But luckily, I don't think that this drive-through, the drive-through person did either. Because then she also said that she had a very different opinion of Wright. Quote, he was creepy, just the way he carried himself and the way he didn't speak, she said. So, I don't know. To me, that kind of backfired. They also attempted to use witness Gary Ross of Springview, Nebraska. And I remember this is about where he rolled the SUV and whatnot. And they said that they wanted to prove that a figure that Ross saw getting into the passenger side of the SUV was actually Wright, not Ann. So they were trying to say that Ann was the one driving the SUV and therefore trying not to escape. I'm not sure how they expected that to go either, because eyewitness accounts can be really unreliable, especially when it's just one person and they're from a distance. Like, that's iffy. That's very, very iffy. Luckily, though, the evidence presented by the prosecution proved very much otherwise, such as, you know, they had to do the rape kit, which proved that it was not consensual. They had multiple eyewitnesses at the mall parking lot that, you know, told what they saw, that it was not a her going with him willingly situation. Plus, they had just different fingerprints on the inside of different areas. They had the notes that she left. They had the chain, you know, different. They had so much evidence against him. I don't know what his defense. I know I understand defense attorneys. Some of them are sleazeballs. Some of them are just trying to do their job. But man, trying to defend somebody like this when you know they're guilty as sin, I don't even know how you do it. So, he was found on June 19th, 2002. The jury returned its verdict, finding Wright guilty on both counts of kidnapping and a firearm charge. On September 16th, 2002, at age 31, Wright was sentenced by the district court to a term of life imprisonment on the kidnapping conviction. On the kidnapping conviction alone, he was given life in prison. Which, that alone kind of boggles my mind. Not in a bad way. Like, I think it's well deserved, but you have people who kill someone who don't get a life sentence like that. And I forgot to totally look like what state this actually took, I guess, place in, because he crossed state lines, which I would assume since he was actually caught in Montana, that he may have been tried in Montana, but I don't know for sure because he had that original charge in Minnesota and then he had charges in Nebraska. Because obviously he had some gun charges there, and that's where he kidnapped her from. And then he was caught in Montana, but he had also gone through South Dakota. I'm not sure. I totally forgot to look where he was actually tried. Either way, go you judge for this. So on top of that life imprisonment, he also had a seven-year. So he got term of life imprisonment on the kidnapping conviction and a term of 7 years to be served consecutively for knowingly brandishing a firearm in the furtherance of this crime. So not only that, he got 7 extra years added on top of that. Judge Warren Erbaum said in handing down the sentence, quote, "I can't count on age and time to rehabilitate Mr. Zappa." Remember, that's the other name he goes by, is Zappa. So given his past and the difficulties he has caused for people, culminating in this crime. So this is the judge saying, like, yeah, I don't see this guy being rehabilitated, and I think he's going to continue to be a danger to society. So I'm just going to throw the book at him. Claps to you, Judge. In the following years from that conviction, Wright appealed to court numerous times, trying to get the conviction lessened or overturned, and was unsuccessful. As far as I could find, he still remains incarcerated today at the federal penitentiary in Atwater, California. And as far as I could see, it was a high-level, maximum security prison, too. And some of these appeals that he was trying to do it on, because this is where he got a lot of this court evidence, like, it was just stupid stuff. Like, still trying to prove that she went with him willingly and that his name was wrong. And, like, ew, just dumb shit. And they were just like, nah, dude. Nope, you did it. Screw you. Now, the family of Wright, some of them actually stood behind him, with one of his sisters saying that his childhood hardships were to blame for the way that Wright wound up. At one point in time during childhood, his two sisters, two brothers, and himself lived out of a car. But it wasn't really clear, like, why they were in a car or how long they were in the car. They also had to face an often drunken, violent father. Wright's mother, Barb McNeely of Frederick, Wisconsin, had a hard time believing her son abducted Anne. Quote, "Tony is a violent person, but not that kind of violent person," said McNeely, who at that time was 48. "For him to pick up a 17-year-old kid doesn't sound right." So what kind of a violent person is he exactly? He's not that kind of... What kind of violent are we talking here? Like, what point would he have to get to before you consider him a violent person, dear? Like, yeah, no, he's violent. McNeely believes he was influenced by the poor behavior of his father, Julius. Quote, "His dad," she said, quote, "taught him plenty. Not all good." Okay, yeah, let's blame it. Yep, totally somebody else's fault. Like, let's not let him take any responsibility for his own actions. All right. His father, Julius Zappa, so that's where Zappa comes from, and Barb McNeely were together 25 years, although they never married. Julius moved his family frequently, from Minnesota to Wisconsin to Iowa and back again, because he had odd jobs, so he just kind of went where the jobs were. Quote, "His dad wasn't very stable," said Lenny Zappa, a 34-year-old cousin of Zappa's who lives in Charles City. "I wouldn't say Tony was a bad kid. They always used to come visit us, and he never had a problem." Okay, so things weren't affecting him that much at that time. And the family finally did settle down in a cabin in the small eastern Minnesota town of Askov when Wright was 11 years old. They stayed there for 8 years, offering more stability than they've ever had before. The same sister who was defending him earlier and saying that his childhood caused his problems, Candy, still speaks fondly of the security she felt there. Okay. So his childhood and his upbringing were what caused him to be that person, but at the same time he felt secure? Okay. But Julius Zappa's alcoholism continued to disrupt the family, according to her. Their father was kind and caring when he was sober, but that wasn't often. Before he had surrendered at the end of this all, his mother had said, quote, "In truth, he probably ran because he was scared. He's a big boy, but he's a big baby too. He's scared right now, I'm sure of it. The public see him as a dangerous man who isn't easily intimidated because of his size." No, sweetie. The public see him as a dangerous man because he kidnapped a 17-year-old. That's why. Oh. Even after his arrest and conviction, his mother and even his father eventually stood behind him and were even ones helping in filing these appeals. Now, I can understand his parents, to a certain extent, being a mother myself, especially his mom, not wanting to believe that her son was capable of these things. You know, whether it's unconditional love, denial, or even like guilt of raising her children in an atmosphere that they were raised in. But his sister, I am sorry, but if my brother did something like that, I'd be like, who are you? No, you're not a brother of mine anymore. Nope, can't do it. Like I said, it was the mom thing. Part of me can understand. Nobody wants to believe that their child has grown up to do something like that. Nobody wants to. So, and here's the other thing. I put in here, I said, a childhood may shape us, but it doesn't force our path in life, right? That is ours and ours to choose alone. And if his childhood and hardships were so to blame for how he turned out, why did his other siblings not turn out to do the same things? Now, I don't know everything about his siblings, where they all are, but I'm going to assume that not all four of them turned out to be kidnappers, rapists, gun charges, thieves, etc. So if they didn't turn out that way and were raised in the same environment, what excuse does that give him? I don't get that. And like we have decisions to make as adults, and we have to be prepared to take responsibility for them if we make bad decisions. And to blame those decisions on our upbringing is no excuse at all. Like you could feel bad for him as a child. Like if he did have a shitty upbringing, okay, fine. Like we could feel bad for them for having a shitty upbringing, but that is no excuse. Nor does it take away his responsibility as an adult at all. Because there are plenty of people out there that I'm sure I know I've heard about, I'm sure some of you have heard about, who've had it way, way worse than he ever did. And they don't grow up to kidnap, assault, and terrorize an innocent stranger, an innocent teenager for no reason. And I've seen some people that come out of absolutely horrific situations that don't grow up to do that. So using that as an excuse or a justification is awful. Let's take, for example, Anne Slutty, whose life was changed in a very terrible and drastic way, but she did not use it and use it as an excuse to lead a terrible life. So let's talk, end on a happy note here. Let's talk about Anne Slutty and where she kind of went to. Now, the most recent info I could actually find on Anne was from an article in 2009 in which her parents were interviewed by John Walsh shortly after the Lifetime movie Taken in Broad Daylight aired. Now, mind you, I watched this movie. If you're looking for one that is at all sticking to facts, don't watch this movie. Yeah, it's based on this, but let's face it, it's a Lifetime movie. If you guys know anything about Lifetime movies, it's all about the drama. It's all about that kind of, like, it's very dramatized. We'll just put it that way. So don't go looking at it like a documentary. If you want, like, a very, very kind of watered down, dramatic version of events, go for it, watch it. But if you want anything factual, that's not the one to go for. But after it was released, he had sat down and interviewed her parents. And this is a quote from her father. Or sorry. In 2009, at 25 years old, Anne had graduated from the Rose Hulman Institute of Technology and lived in Indiana, where she worked as an engineer. It's a career that fits her matter-of-fact personality, said her parents. This is a quote from her father.
She's very factual and doesn't like to repeat herself, and if there's the right way to do it, that's the right way to do it. Elaine Slutty, Anne's mom, added, she's concerned about others. She doesn't say mean things. about people or anything. She's just a nice person, but she's not wishy-washy. They also added that Anne focuses on today. She's only worried now that people will identify her as a victim, and she doesn't want that. She says, no, I want to live my life, said Dawn. And from anything else I've looked at online, she basically, as far as I can tell, she's kept a low profile and chosen to stay out of any social or news spotlights, the limelight. And I respect that. And that's why I hadn't reported on this before. I was kind of trying to look more on, like, where is she at now? But I can understand. And I respect her privacy in that matter to be able to just live a quote-unquote normal life and not have to be seen as a victim anymore. So that, you guys, is the amazing survival story of Anne Slutty. Again, a solo episode. I hope it wasn't too dull today, since there was no other commentary or reactions or anything else like that. So it's kind of weird sitting here, like I said, talking to myself. So I'm hoping I did okay. You guys will just have to let me know if you hated it or if you liked it. I don't even know right now. If you have any suggestions, though, or for us, please email us at nocturnaldistractions@gmail.com. You can follow us on all of our socials. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we would love, love, love to hear from you guys that are listening out there to get onto Instagram, send us a DM, let us know what you think, give us some suggestions. You can rate us on Spotify, or if you'd like to leave an actual written review, which we would love even more, Apple Podcasts and Audible, I believe, are the only places that allow you to do that. If you click on Linktree in our show notes, you will find all of the listening platforms we're on. Our case request form, if you have a case you want us to cover, our social links, links to our one-time donation pages, along with our Patreon page, which is a monthly subscription with tiers ranging from $2 to $6. Each one has different perks, which I know haven't been... We only have like 2 patrons right now, and I would love to see more, and I promise you two out there, we'll get better on releasing episodes early, because I completely forget. And we're going to start working on bonus episodes and making sure that all the stuff on there that we do finally get posted is ad-free content and is uploaded early, like I said. Again, my apologies. But I've had to work out some technical kinks in order to get, like, the ad-free content and things going. And hopefully it will get better. And the more donations or patrons we get, the better content and hopefully we'll be able to start getting merch and some better stickers and things like that to give you guys. Hopefully April will be back next time with us, so I'm not talking to myself alone. I mean, you guys are listening now, but otherwise I'm just sitting here talking to myself. But have a good night. I love all of you, and tune in next time. Bye.